Welcome back to Real World Rewind, a monthly podcast where we take a look back at some of our favorite movies from years gone by, reminding ourselves that entertainment is not mindless. Joining me on this week's episode is Reed Lackey. Hey, Reed, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Blaine. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Well, our film for this show is one of my all-time favorite movies, and I think it's one of Reed's as well, The Iron Giant.
Oh, yes.
Now, it was released in 1999, directed, of course, by Brad Bird. It was his first feature-length film, and it features the voice talents of Eli Marienthal, Harry Connick Jr., and Jennifer Aniston, among others. We're doing this episode in September to celebrate the release of the Blu-ray release of the signature edition of The Iron Giant, which came out earlier this month. So let's dive right into this very wonderful and very dense movie. Now, Reed, on last month's episode, Mark Wingerder and I talked about the Disney film The Rocketeer.
Yes.
And we pointed out how this movie seems to have had quite an influence on Brad Bird. And you can listen to that that episode last month to sort of catch up on that discussion. And Mark brought up a really good question that I'm going to ask you. So what are some of the sources from which we see Brad Bird drawing inspiration in The Iron Giant?
I would think if I were to pinpoint just a couple, Brad Bird is clearly a fan of atomic age science fiction, both the literature and film. There's references in here, some of them minor and some of them a bit more overt, to The Day the Earth Stood Still, to War of the Worlds, and specifically War of the Worlds as in the filmed version from the 50s, not the iconic classic book itself. And a lot of the visual imagery is dependent upon some of the stylistic choices from science fiction films of the 50s. Another influence that I would throw in to inform the tone is I think Brad Bird, I'm resistant saying this because their names are so similar, but Brad Bird is clearly a fan of Ray Bradbury, and a lot of the tone in The Iron Giant strikes me as something that Ray Bradbury could have written. Bradbury was very focused on idyllic America, but he was always really focused on the future and the potentials for the future, and looking at it from this perspective of where can we go from here and what can we do. And I think that that informs a lot of what Brad Bird is doing within The Iron Giant. So he's clearly a fan of the sort of, as I said, the atomic age science fiction, and I think specifically the work of Ray Bradbury as just a place setting for the tone that he's trying to strike in The Iron Giant.
Oh, that's really good. I had not even thought about Bradbury. Of course, The Iron Giant itself is based on a children's novel by Ted Hughes. I think if you buy the book is called The Iron Giant. But originally, when it was released in the UK, because Hughes is a British author, it was called The Iron Man. And they sort of rebranded it not only to match with the movie's title later on, but also to distinguish the character from Iron Man, the comic book character.
Right.
But the book, Ted Hughes' book, is great in its own right, but it drastically diverges from its source material. I mean, the book and the film basically share two narrative similarities. There's an Iron Giant, number one, and number two, there's a boy named Hogarth. But the book, which again is very good, I mean, it has a huge singing dragon who flies around. It's just wildly different from the movie. So I think this is always an interesting film to bring to mind when you're having discussions about adaptations, especially since for so many viewers, it seems like the success or failure of a movie adaptation is measured in terms of fidelity to the book primarily. This is a great movie that sort of gets at why that might be a problematic metric as a way to sort of look at adaptation.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. Just one small little comment on that. My apologies for interrupting you.
No,
but
not at all.
I think that there's a lack of understanding, I think, from a vast majority of deeply entrenched fan culture that when you approach an adaptation, and I know I'm guilty of this, many, many people who have lived with certain aspects of material for a very long period of time, they become beholden to that interpretation of that material. And then when a movie takes a different path with something, then it offends their sensibilities. And they object to the particular thing that the film is trying to say simply on the basis of the fact that it wasn't like this previous material that they so fell in love with. And I do agree with you that that can be problematic. I think what we have to do is we have to say, okay, did the adapter allow inspiration from that source material to go into a different, interesting direction that we can at least appreciate, maybe even enjoy on its own merits? Or is it something where we genuinely think that they have a word is escaping me that seems appropriate, but where they've basically taken this material and capitalized on the fandom for an excuse to do something entirely different that holds no affection for the original source material. Because I do believe there's a responsibility in adaptation to use the material as inspiration. But I don't think that we should be so rigid in making sure that that inspiration maintains the same level of integrity to its original beats that the source material did, makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's a really good point. And if anybody's interested, go read Ted Hughes' novel. You can read it in an hour or two. It's a very, very short book. And then watch the movie and see how these two texts interact. It's a very interesting thing to do.
Cool.
But this movie also strikes me, at least, as sort of a love letter to 2D animation in a time, again, released in 1999, when 3D animation was really taking off. I mean, so of course you've had Toy Story released by this point, and Pixar is sort of, you know, is amping up and becoming just a really big phenomenon. And so Brad Bird has really penned a love letter to an animation style that, at least at that time, probably a lot of people were afraid was dying out or was going to be eclipsed by 3D animation.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, it's funny because the only computer component to the entire animation of Iron Giant is the giant himself. Everything else that you see is that, and it looks so crisp. This is why I'm so glad you pointed it out, because if you go and you watch that film, computers can do outstanding things. They can create all kinds of imaginary worlds that we could really only dream of before. But there is such a, I will call it magic, quality to the art present in hand-drawn cells framed, you know, however many, 23 frames per second, that the time it takes to craft those scenes and the imagination that requires them to be fluid and look fluid. What impresses me so much about the fact that Iron Giant is a 2D animated film is that, partially because the story is so rich, but also the characters seem to really come alive. You never lose the fact that they are animated beings, but they really just leap off the page. You begin to leap off the screen. They begin to take on a life of their own in a way that I think there's always a little bit of a disconnect when I see something that is inherently computer generated. Now, I do love the Toy Story movies, so that I'm not going to get into all of that because I'm so, so affectionate for them. But I think there is a part of me that grieves a little bit the lost art of 2D animation, because it is beautiful, and the care that goes into it. You go back and watch Pinocchio or Snow White and think about the time that it took to put those films together. It's outstanding. It's outstanding work, and it really is. There's a magic to it.
Bird has also mentioned before that probably at the time that The Iron Giant was released, the most readily available inspiration was the Disney musicals of the 1990s. And actually, The Iron Giant was originally envisioned as a musical. Thankfully, however, the studio was happy to let Brad Bird take things in his own direction. And I can't imagine what an Iron Giant musical would look like. But I'm glad that we've got what Brad Bird has given us.
Exactly. By The Who, right? The Who. Right. Pete Townsend was going to do it, right?
Yeah.
That strikes me as so odd.
Yeah.
I can't picture it.
So yeah, this you, how did you put it? You said that Bird is drawing from science fiction.
Oh, Atomic Age. Atomic science Age. Fiction. A very yeah, and if I can take just a 30, 45 seconds here, absolutely, the distinction there being a lot of the science fiction that we see today, actually, is what we would call dystopian science fiction, where mm-hmm. it's envisioning a future that is a bit bleak, where there's these oppressive regimes. It's George Orwell's 1984. There's all of these visions of the future that are very just bleak and dire, whereas Atomic Age science fiction was very focused. Everything is larger. Everything is has a sort of a sheen to it that it looks inviting, and it's very in the 50s. They envisioned the future as, you know, they called it the world of tomorrow, and it was this idea that in the future we are going to progressively get better and better and better, and that all of these, you know, images of buildings and these ideas of what we will, how we will operate as a society, you know, automated cars on tracks. It's the Jetsons. I mean, yeah. It's essentially, the Jetsons is a perfect example of what Atomic Age science fiction is supposed to look like. And so that's a very distinctly different vision of the future from most of what is common today, which is clearly very dystopian, bleak, dire, political oppression. That's largely informs a lot of what we see as science fiction today. You don't see a tremendous amount of the kind of science fiction that Iron Giant clearly is beholden to and is affectionate for.
Yeah, it's interesting that Bird, like how you pointed that out, he's using these sort of frightening scenarios or frightening places in American history to deliver a really optimistic sort of outlook on life. Because he yeah. seems to be pulling a lot from some of Disney's wartime propaganda films, or some of the propaganda films you would see during the Cold War era. So here in The Iron Giant, there's that scene where Hogarth and his classmates are watching the prop film in class that's detailing a nuclear attack and what mm-hmm. during a nuclear attack. And that's actually a direct reference to a 1951 film called Duck and Cover. This was a film yeah. that was shown to kids, especially in the New York area, during the 50s. And it featured a cute little musical number, Duck and Cover, and a character named Bert the Turtle. And so this scene was very much that scene in The Iron Giant was very much a real thing that actually happened in the 1950s.
Yeah.
I'm going to put that video in the show notes, by the way, so that you can watch that. It's
that's awesome.
It's quite a terrifying thing, actually, in a way. This video shown to little kids, telling them how to prepare for this imminent attack.
Oh yeah, it's true.
But that kind of creates. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, yeah, it's funny when you think about how they were preparing for what they would literally deem nuclear disaster by. Oh, huddle under your desk.
Yeah.
Get under wood and put your hands over your head. And inside the video, if you're gonna share this specific video, inside the video you can see, like, when the bomb blasts, everything around the child is a crater. But he's yeah. standing there, he's huddled under, you know, safely because he ducked and covered.
Yeah.
It's so funny to me.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's great. Well, so, I mean, The Iron Giant, as I mentioned a couple of times before, was released in 1999, but it's set in 1957 and draws very, very heavily from this Cold War setting. So obviously the kids who saw this movie in the theaters during its original run, like myself, we weren't alive during the 50s or the 60s. So this might initially seem like sort of an unusual setting, or one at least that maybe wouldn't resonate with a younger audience, would go over their heads. But I want to ask you, is that the case? And what does this Cold War setting do for the film as a whole? How might it bring thematic content home in a particular way? Can you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. And some of these thoughts are a bit half-formed. So I'll lead with the formed thoughts. That I think that particularly a story like this, there was an atmosphere. I obviously didn't live in the 50s, so I wouldn't be able to speak specifically to how it felt to live in the 50s. But from the literature that we see and that's been passed down to us, and from the stories from our parents and grandparents, there was a sense that we had it very, very good, that we had everything in order and everything aligned, but that there was also this paranoia that there were imminent threats always in the periphery, and that these imminent threats were going to come in and upend this idyllic scenario that we have. I think about the moment specifically in the movie where, you know, the giant is carrying Hogarth. He's going to go into the town, and Hogarth stopped him, and he stops him with, you know, they're not ready for you. They're not ready for you yet. And it's this idea that people will see something new. They'll see something that they can't explain, and that the immediate feeling that they have is this is going to destroy everything, so we have to destroy it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is something very specific to that era of the 50s. You're not quite getting into the revolutionary age of the 60s, and you're definitely not quite getting into the sort of glut of capitalistic optimism from the 80s. You're still present in this sort of bubble in the 50s. And I think that's a big part of why the giant needed to come at that time. Now, what's interesting about that to me is we're approaching, and I intentionally do not want to derail us into some vast political statement, but I think that we are approaching a period with certain social and political elements where we're approaching that same kind of thing. It's just been interesting to watch how there can be that same kind of language of like, well, we are here and we have to protect our own because there are threats out there that are going to come in and they're going to upend everything good that we have. And it's just been interesting, almost as a sociological perspective, to look and say, wow, this is an attitude, a mindset that is actually quite old. And yet it's seeming to have a resurgence. And I think part of what Iron Giant scratches at is that notion of we actually don't quite understand everything that's beyond our bubble. We simply don't.
Yeah.
And our own cultural experience is not the definitive cultural experience. We just simply don't know. And unless we are willing, with some discernment and with some wisdom, unless we are willing to not be so immediately inherently defensive, then we're going to possibly miss out on some really beautiful opportunities. And I have more to say about that in the actual narrative of the film, but to get back to the second part of your question directly about how did children understand this, one thing that I found really interesting is that kids today, I think, still have an automatic response to the world of tomorrow imagery and the ideas of, you know, big buildings and you know, fancy cars. I think about my son. We take him to Disneyland, and when we're walking around through Tomorrowland, which, you know, might as well be deemed Star Wars land now, right? But when we're walking around through Disneyland and he's seeing all these big things, one of his favorite rides in Tomorrowland is still the rockets. This yeah. big tower with circling rockets all around. And I think about whenever we do that, I'm like, wow. And he loves Autopia as well. It's a very mm-hmm. similar kind of thing,
yeah.
Where it's this idea of, you know, just this is what the future will look like. You know, of course he loves Star Wars. Of course he loves the superheroes. Of course he gets excited about that. But I find it interesting that children, I think, still respond to that kind of imagery. And I think that kind of imagery specifically might just be timeless. I mean, I know that's a broad statement, but I think that might just be timeless, to where it would not necessarily matter that you didn't grow up in that era. The imagery of this is what the future can look like that was really birthed in that era, I think, still resonates with people today. So I don't necessarily think it would hinder any kids' enjoyment of it. My son's seen The Iron Giant, and he loved it, as I think most kids would. He's only 4. He saw it when he was 3, okay. And he still loved it. And so I think there is still this sort of timeless quality to the imagery and the tone that won't hinder, even if you weren't born in that era, to really resonate with the socio-political themes that might inform that era, you're still going to respond to the tone and the image that's present in the movie.
So, of course, the Cold War, like you mentioned, was a time of great fear and suspicion. I mean, the Red Scare made it right. So that American society as a whole, like citizens, were inculcated with this idea that everyone was a potential communist, right? You couldn't trust anyone.
Right.
You had to watch out for your neighbor. But the fear of nuclear annihilation itself manifested itself then fundamentally in the fear of the alien, the outsider. Mm-hmm. I was afraid of this thing, like you said, that's coming from outside and disrupting this sort of perfect harmony we have. And that's really nothing new. I don't think that that's – certainly it manifested itself in a unique way during the Cold War. But, I mean, now you have – I mean, you have 9/11, and so you have this
right, –
since 9/11, right. You have this idea that you've got this enemy that you can't locate, right? At least during the Cold War, like, we knew it was Russia. And so you could point to Russia right. on a map and identify this enemy. So at least even if you were scared of them and they were the outsider, you could identify them. But now you have right. things like ISIS, right? You have all these terrorist mm-hmm. cells that they're hiding. You can't just go find them. You can't point to them specifically on a map.
Yeah.
And so this fear of the alien and the outsider, this is something that I think resonates with people of every generation because we live in a broken world where there are always going to be these sorts of things. They may be manifesting themselves in different ways, but those fears are always there. Fear of the outsider, fear of something that's going to disrupt this perfect world that we've crafted for ourselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and that's something that has become, as I've gotten older and you know, my son's 4, and this is a common experience, but once your children begin to get a little older, you begin to think about what kind of world are they going to be adults in, and what kind of world are they going to be teenagers in, what kind of, not necessarily the specific statement of what kind of world are we leaving for them, but how can I equip them with the idea that, with the ideas that will help them to navigate through the world in a good way, and in a fruitful way. And it's interesting because you talk about I call it the other. A lot of other people call mm-hmm. it the other, but you know, you said the outsider and this notion that there is someone or something that is going to, like we've talked about already, upend everything that we have idyllically set in place. But what the real danger is when we begin to see those who are not really outsiders as outsiders. And then suddenly this mm-hmm. this paranoia sort of begins to feed on itself, and it begins to grow exponentially and snowball within our own mindset that now we're perceiving threats that are not legitimate threats. One thing that I thought about, and I can't recall, do you want to avoid spoilers for Iron Giant for anybody who's seen it, or do we want to see
everybody? No, everybody's spoil seen? Away.
Okay, so there's, as we know, there's this moment where the Iron Giant begins to reveal itself to be weaponized mm-hmm. in some way. And what's interesting to me, you know, I've talked about this on one other podcast before, or at least scratched at this idea, but he is potentially very destructive.
Mm-hmm.
But the solution to that, from Kent Mansley, who works for the government, his perspective is we've got to blow it away. You know, I pulled up one particular quote because he says at one point to Hogarth, he says, you know, who built it? The Russians, the Chinese, the Martians, Canadians? I don't care. Yeah. All we know is we didn't build it, and that's reason enough to assume the worst and blow it to kingdom come. You know, and that's his solution to the problem. And what I wanted to say that I think all of us should probably be a bit cautious about in our current political climate, or in our dealings one-to-one in our relationships with each other, is that just because you are aware and accurate and correct about the danger that is present, because if somebody looked at the Iron Giant, they'd be like, this is a weapon.
Yeah.
And they'd be right. They'd be correct.
Yeah.
But just because you're correct about the danger does not necessarily mean you are correct about the best possible solution to avert that danger or to disarm that danger. Because I think we have a tendency to believe that once we have correctly identified the problem, then clearly our ideas about how to fix it are the right ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a dangerous mentality to adopt, whether you're talking about a large scale or in your own home and in your own family. And I think that one of the things we have to do that I think Iron Giant illustrates beautifully in the fact that, okay, yes, he is this thing, but there is a relationship that he has that has affected whether or not he will be that thing and continue to be that thing.
Right.
And, you know, not over-spiritualizing or over-emotionalizing the thing. In the narrative itself, it is a relationship, not a greater force of weaponry. It is a relationship that unends the threat, that causes the Iron Giant to not want to be this thing that he was clearly made to be. And it's that relationship that he has with Hogarth that changes that conversation. And what I really wish for myself, for my family, for my friends, and for our country, for the world at large, what I really wish is that we could begin to take a step back and say, okay, the problem is real. We know that the problem is real. But maybe there's a different solution that we could arrive to that will still nullify the problem, that will still get us out of the way, but won't cause so much destruction in its weight, and won't cause it, as Camp Mansley almost does, to destroy ourselves. If that makes sense.
It does. Very, very well put. I mean, so the beautiful, wonderful, and deeply biblical irony of the Iron Giant is that the salvation, literally, of the world in the movie comes from the other, from the outsider, mm-hmm. from the mm-hmm. most unexpected of places, right? From the sort of Nazareth of the world, if you will,
yeah.
right? Can anything
yeah.
good come out of this machine that we don't know who built it? And I like how you pointed out Kent Mansley's line. But yeah, so the irony is that salvation comes from the most unexpected of places, even from the very people that we might pick out as an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just this beautifully deep, biblical, rich irony that's embedded in this movie. And this movie yeah. has a lot to say about identity. Is there anything else you want to flesh out a little bit more for us?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really has resonated so profoundly to me, I haven't mentioned this on the show yet, but I am a rather obsessive about making lists. I enjoy categorizing and ranking things. It is some weird sadistic fun for me. I every year update, based on the new movies I've seen and films that have kind of fallen out, a list of my favorite 250 films, and put them in lists on Letterboxd and do all this other kind of great stuff. Well, the reason I point that out is because Iron Giant has consistently been in the top 10 every single time I've done that. It has climbed from it started at 5 and has now climbed to 4. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it'll ever quite crack the top 3 because of what's in those places, but Iron Giant is so special to me. And one of the reasons, to get back to your question about identity, is because that moment, that climactic moment, where he's looking around and the idea of you are who you choose to be. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try to be careful in how I say this, because there are people who have deep feelings and probably better theological understandings than I have. But here's what I see at play in The Iron Giant and what it informs me from a faith perspective. So Iron Giant is designed by someone. We don't know who, and the story doesn't care, and we probably shouldn't care either. But he's designed by someone to be a weapon. That is, like, he has that capability. He has the capability to be a gun. That is in his nature. That is the function that he seems to serve. But because of a relationship that he develops with Hogarth, he then chooses and looks right at him. And this is powerful to me. He looks right at Hogarth and says, "I am not a gun." And the reason that I even got mildly choked up when I made that statement is because technically, yeah, maybe he is.
Yeah.
But he looks down and he says, "No, I am not this." And I think that we all have an understanding. Now, we were not designed to be this way, but we are born into a nature that is sinful and that makes bad decisions and that does horrible things. And there can be a mentality that says we're just resigned to that. Well, this is just how it's going to be. This is, we're always going to mess up. We're always going to do that. Sure, we should recognize our fallibility. We should recognize our flaws. But there is such an immense power that through a relationship that we have available to us, we can look and say, "I am not this. I am not defined by this. I am not, this is not my identity." Yeah. My identity is not locked into the bad choices that I've made. You know, I think about, you could say, you know, like, I am a thief, or I am, you know, a murderer, to quote the very old Third Day song. But, you know, like, I am these these wicked things. And here's the other component of it to connect to what we were talking about the outsider. People will call you those things. They will say this about you. You are this. You are that. You are this other. You are this deplorable thing. And it takes a tremendous amount of courage, but it is powerful to stand up and say, I am not this thing. Like, I am not. Even though there is empirical evidence that this is a component of my makeup and it is a component of how I operate to a degree, this does not define me. And this is not going to encapsulate everything that I am and will be and choose to be. And then, of course, when Iron Giant is making that tear-jerking decision towards the end of the film, it still chokes me up to think about as he's flying forward. You know, because in the comic book, Hogarth shows him the Metal Man is the one that Superman has to fight.
Yeah.
And the Metal Man is the villain of the story. And, oh, there's so much that we don't have time to talk about unpacking that whole idea of, like, he sees, wait a minute, I'm the villain. I look like the villain. Mm-hmm. I look like the bad guy. But then as he's flying up and Hogarth's words echo back in his memory, he says, you are who you choose to be. And then you see that smile go across the Iron Giant's face as he's about to sacrifice himself to save the whole town. You are who you choose to be. And he says to himself, Superman, like, I'm not the villain. I'm the good guy. And, oh, Blaine.
I know. Can we just stop and cry for a few minutes and we'll reconvene? Everybody stop.
Oh, yes, please. Because it is such a beautiful moment. And it is something that I think we need to, as believers, as people, we need to stop and reflect on this more than we do. That moment of, you know what, we have a nature. And that nature needs to be probably acknowledged. It needs to be confronted. It needs to be addressed. But we are not summed up by our past. We are not summed up. We are not the sum total of what our histories have made of us. We are not the sum total of what our poor choices have made of us. That there is a possibility of a word we haven't used yet, but it is redemption.
Yes.
That's inherent in the possibilities available to us through what Christ has done for us and through the potential relationships that we may develop in other people, we can take a step back and go, wow, I am not this thing. I am not this other thing. In John chapter 8, they brought the woman who committed adultery. They brought her out there. I'm not going to preach a mini sermon here, but I just want to point out that you know, after Jesus had silenced them all, which, by the way, hearkening back to our earlier conversation, they were technically correct. Yeah. About what the law said. They were technically correct about what, quote unquote, they should have done. Mm-hmm. And Jesus, in that moment, spoke something different that changed the tone of the conversation, that changed it and made it about, you know, as we know in a broader spectrum, made it about relationship and made it about perspective. And then he steps forward to her, and the first thing he identifies is, hey, where are all those people who called you these things? Where are all these people who placed these labels and these names on you? Where are your accusers? And then, of course, when she sees them nowhere, he says, well, I'm not one. I'm not one of them. Neither do I condemn you. And, of course, he tells her, go and sin no more. Again, I'm not preaching a mini sermon here. I just want to point out that there is the possibility inherent in our faith that we do not have to identify specifically with the negative, the bad things that attach itself to our natures, that attach itself to our lives and the choices that we've made previous. We are not resigned to be defined by those things. Other people might do it. Kent Mansley's, they might do it. But that doesn't mean that's who you are, because there is a relationship present that says you can be something else. Okay, I'm done.
No, that's wonderful. And I really do mean that. Thank you so much for bringing all of that out. It's fun to look at this film on a narrative level, in a historical context, talk about its production. But for me, any conversation about the Iron Giant would be incomplete if I didn't talk about what this movie means to both of us personally. Because this is a very personal movie. So what's your personal connection to the Iron Giant? Why do you love it? How did you come to love it? Was it on your own, showing it to your kids? And maybe how has your appreciation for it changed and grown throughout the years?
Well, I'll keep this brief. So I actually missed it the weekend it came out because, unfortunately, as timing would have it. It came out the same weekend as The Sixth Sense, and that, you know, being a big fan of horror films, that was more on my radar, even though I do have a tremendous affection for animated films. So I missed it in theater. But then my family, we loved to watch movies together, but my parents were very sensitive, as many conservative families were, to content. You know, it couldn't have a lot of bad language, couldn't have any sex or violence or anything like that. So the search for movies that would be palatable for us all to watch was limited, and it was a little tricky because this is before the Parents Guide on IMDb. You know, this was We just had to trust the back of the box, the MPAA rating. And I first saw Iron Giant simply because it was a Sunday afternoon. We were home from church, wanted to watch a movie. I went to the video store. Rest in peace, video stores. I went to the video store and found this movie, and I was like, "Oh, this looks interesting. I wanted to see this. Let me bring this home. It'll be safe and clean for everybody." So I think my dad might have fallen asleep, and I think my mom was, you know, sort of lost interest about the half hour. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there, jaw open, like, what did I just rent? Oh my goodness, this is incredible. Like, the story captivated me, the characters captivated me, the animation was beautiful, it captivated me. And so I loved it from that moment. But then as time has gone on, specifically the moment I already mentioned, the climactic moment, the general tone of, you know, when he's talking about, you know, souls never die and things like that, and just the things in subtle ways that the film is playing with thematically just began to grow in my heart. And it was one of my special Father's Day days that when we first showed this movie to my son, where I was like, okay, you know, the very first Father's Day showed him Finding Nemo, and then the next one showed him Iron Giant, and I was like, this is a very, very special movie. And as I'm sitting there watching it with him, I'm like, this is how I want him to see the world, that this is the way we can be. Not the Kinsmansleys, not the paranoia, not the distrust. I want him to see that this kind of relationship is possible. And as the things we've already talked about identity, and the things that we've talked about self-sacrifice and redemption, those things have just so exponentially grown in my heart and mind and made this movie really quite precious to me, to where it is a special film in the sense that it's not common for me as an animated film. Mm-hmm. If I talk about favorite animated movies, I would definitely put this at the top, but it's almost belongs on a different list because The way I love so many other animated films is not quite comparable to the way I love The Iron Giant.
Yeah, it really is special. And I'm looking forward to one day being able to sit down with my kid and show them this movie. I'm sure that's an incredibly special experience. So I got to see this movie in theaters when I was a kid. I still have really fond memories of seeing the trailers on TV and just pushing my mom to go see it. And we went to see it. And you used the word earlier, so I'm going to use it here. It was one of the most magical experiences I've ever had in a theater. I just remember, like you said, jaw open. I was just floored. I think what resonated with me at that time was I lived, my parents were divorced, and I lived in a single-parent household at the time. So Hogarth really, really resonated with me as a character.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was just blown away. It spoke to me on a deeply personal level. It was fun. It was funny. But my love and appreciation for this movie has grown exponentially over time, and it's changed. This is a movie that's grown with me. Like it collects all of these memories. I mean, this movie really is like a like a repository for all of these memories I have associated with this film. Now I just I love the prayer scene where Hogarth is praying with his mother and the giant's
so
hand is
great.
I probably think about that at least once a week and just start laughing about it.
It's so great.
It is. And then I guess it was earlier this year, I had the opportunity to host a public screening of this movie at a local movie theater.
Oh, wow.
And that was, so I got to get up and do a little bitty introduction for it. And that was fun because I got to talk about The Iron Giant. But the most amazing thing was seeing it again in theaters with people. Some people were there showing their kids the movie for the first time. And I'm not kidding when I... I get out early, or not early, but I sort of leave right as the credits roll to go tell everybody bye, thank you for coming out as they're leaving. And there's not a dry eye.
Oh,
Everyone's weeping. And of course, I had already wept, and I was trying to, you know, clean up my face so that I wouldn't just look like terribly distraught as I'm telling everyone goodbye. This is just such a special movie, and it will only continue to grow with me over the years.
Yeah.
As I, Lord willing, have children one day and get to share this with them.
Yeah,
so it's really special. I know we've gone a little over time. I'm not even going to pretend to apologize because this movie's so wonderful. Reed, thank you so much for sharing all that. You've been very eloquent. You've shared some wonderful, wonderful things.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So this is going to wrap up this episode of Real World Rewind. But before we go, Reed, you've started a new podcast. You're on social media. Why don't you take a few minutes to tell us about your podcast? What is it? What is your podcast like? Where can we find it? Where can we find you on social media?
Sure. So my podcast is called The Fear of God, and it is an examination of the intersection between Christianity and the horror genre. Specifically, every week we look at a film. We're going to primarily be talking about films, but we have a couple of episodes planned coming up where we branch out, talk about some literature. We're going to eventually be talking about perhaps even a little bit of music, some specific songs that kind of deal with some horror themes. But basically, we look at opportunities for things in the horror genre to inform a lot of the ways that we think about our faith and a lot of how we navigate through the world as people of faith. And so it's myself and my co-host Nathan Rouse. We have a conversation every week just about whatever our film or subject is for that week, and we're having a lot of fun. And it's really been very well received so far, which I'm very grateful for. And it's just called The Fear of God. You can also follow me on Twitter, just at Reed Lackey. And you can also find me as one of the rotating co-hosts at Tyler Smith's show, More Than One Lesson, over on morethanonelesson.com. There's a few different places where you could reach me, and the Real World Theology Group. I've become rather active there as of late.
Yeah. So make sure you check out all of Reed's stuff. I'm going to link to it in the post for this show. So please check all of Reed's work out. You could find me on Twitter. I'll link to that. You can also find my work at Real World Theology and over at Christ and Pop Culture. Thank you so much for taking time out of your week to listen. Again, I really do mean that. It means a lot that people want to listen and be a part of this conversation. And speaking of conversation, please feel free to continue this discussion in the Real World Theology Facebook group. Reed and I will be in there, and we'll talk with you about it. So until next time, thanks for rewinding with us. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!